So even though we face the difficulties of today and tomorrow, I still have a dream. It is a dream deeply rooted in the American dream. I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. I have a dream that one day on the red hills of Georgia, the sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners will be able to sit down together at the table of brotherhood. I have a dream that one day, even the state of Mississippi, a state sweltering with the heat of injustice, sweltering with the heat of oppression, will be transformed into an oasis of freedom and justice. I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today. I have a dream that one day, down in Alabama, with its vicious racists, with its governor having his lips dripping with the words of interposition and nullification, one day right there in Alabama, little black boys and black girls will be able to join hands with little white boys and white girls as sisters and brothers. I have a dream today.
Sunday morning to you. It's Dave Plyer on 720 WGN. So Monday marks the anniversary of the birth of Martin Luther King Jr. During the less than 13 years of Dr. King's leadership of the modern American civil rights movement, African Americans achieved more genuine progress toward racial equality in America than the previous 350 years had produced. Yet in his mere 39 years on the planet, he upended the ways we think about race, capitalism, poverty, power, and imperialism. His vision changed the world, but there is more work to be done. Carried on by the Reverend Jesse Jackson, founder and president of the Rainbow Push Coalition, Reverend Jackson emerged as a prominent voice in the civil rights movements in the 1960s. And to reflect on those early days with Dr. King, Reverend Jackson joins us this morning. Good morning, Reverend Jackson.
Good morning to you, and God bless you.
Thank you, and same to you, sir. You know, from a historical perspective, you began getting involved in local civil rights demonstrations while a student in North Carolina. And back in the early 1960s, what motivated you, Reverend Jackson, as a student to begin this lifelong vocation?
Really, what motivated me was a sense of dignity. My father came back from World War II. Mm-hmm. And black soldiers had to sit behind Nazi prisoners of war on American military bases. It was humiliating. Black Nazi POWs had more rights to the base social processes than black soldiers. That was the humiliation. I tried to use a public library. And with seven classmates, we were arrested trying to use a public library. The laws of segregation were so rigid. The day Dr. King gave the speech in Washington, the I Have a Dream speech, that day from Texas across to Florida up to Maryland, we couldn't use a single public toilet. We could not buy ice cream at Howard Johnson. We could not rent a room at Holiday Inn. Fighting the walls of rigid segregation. Those walls came down, I might add, and using discipline, nonviolent direct action, and a lot of sacrifice. We pulled down those walls and changed laws, and of course, the right to vote.
You know, when
I grew up this struggle.
You know, when I talk to my children about the civil rights movement and what happened really before Dr. King in the 1960s, they almost find it unreal, unbelievable that is the way America operated in so many places.
Well, you know, two things happened in Alabama in the last couple of weeks they should be made aware of. One is that you had Roy Moore running for a senator. It had been expelled from the judiciary twice and was making all kind of obscene racial gestures. He would have won except blacks, women who could now serve on juries. Latinos and 18-year-olds can now vote. If we would not have been able to vote, he would have won Alabama. But because we can vote, we were able to alter the role of the nationalism that America is so global. Also, last Monday night, the big football game between Georgia and Alabama. They should have been singing "We Shall Overcome" at halftime, because that Alabama is a state where George Wallace blocked the school door, said blacks cannot attend the school, and Lester Maddox held up an axe handle symbolizing beating blacks, become governor of Georgia, and yet George Wallace in Alabama, and Lester Maddox, they lost, they can't prevail. You could have that game Monday night, where blacks and whites could play together and sit together and share together, because we pulled down walls of segregation. And furthermore, you wouldn't have had Mercedes-Benz in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, and Toyota in Mississippi had we not been successful.
Well, and looking back to Alabama and Selma, after you graduated college, you went to Alabama to march with Dr. King, eventually becoming a worker in the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. Do you remember the very first time you met Dr. King?
The very first time I had was a student at North Carolina A&T, and I was on the way to give a speech at his college, Morehouse, and he was coming through the airport on the way to get his Nobel Peace Prize.
Wow.
And
wow.
He stunned me because he saw me and he called my name.
Wow.
I had been arrested in Greensboro, North Carolina. He knew about that scene very well. I was, needless to say, overwhelmed, and congratulated him on receiving what he went off to get his Nobel Peace Prize. And then I left the next year and came to grad school at Chicago Theological Seminary at University of Chicago. And Dr. King went on to Selma eventually. And when the goings got hot, he called for seminary students to come meet him in Selma. And I left Chicago Theological Seminary and went to Selma. And we hooked up there and stayed hooked up until he was killed in Memphis in 68.
Yeah, I was going to say, you formally started working for Dr. King after grad school, and you worked in that inner circle for nearly 3 years. That must have been quite surreal. I mean, even looking back at it today, wouldn't you say, Reverend Jackson?
Yeah, the mention of Dr. King is not commonly thought. Dr. King finished high school at 15. He finished college at 19. He finished seminary at 22 and got his PhD at 26. An utterly brilliant man whose courage corresponded with his brilliance. But he also had a worldview. He had a worldview of reconciliation and not retribution. He saw nonviolence as a way of life as well as a tactic. And he believed that people put their bodies on the line and choose to learn to live together, not simply die apart. We could become a better people. And so that kind of philosophy was very appealing to me then and now.
Well, and you became such an integral part of what was happening in Chicago. So just 11 days after Dr. King's 37th birthday and coming off the history-making triumphs in Birmingham and Selma that laid the groundwork for the passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, and a year later, the Voting Rights Act, Dr. King had come to Chicago to make the city the next proving ground for his nonviolent revolution to help eradicate that system which promoted the further colonization of thousands of blacks within a segregated environment. And you were a big part of what was happening here in the city at that time.
Well, Chicago blacks could not live west of Halsted. We hemmed up in these ghettos. You look at the people on the streets who were throwing rocks at us, and one that hit Dr. King in the head with a brick, who called us nasty names. Those kids were the victims. The real villains were the politicians who gerrymandered black and white to live in separate ways and be afraid of each other. It was banks that would not lend, insurance companies that would not insure, and brokers who did what you call blockbusting. Those kids were victims of the racism being taught by the adults. And yet we have made a big decision, and I have spoken more and more. We've learned to survive apart. We must now learn a bigger lesson, learning to live together as brothers and sisters and not die apart as fools.
Well, and I know there was a struggle at that time to get that plan executed, and the movement was largely credited for inspiring the 1968 Fair Housing Act. But, I mean, really, when you look at the city, and I've lived here almost all my life, I mean, there's still segregation, so to speak, in Chicago as well as other cities across America, and maybe we're more conscious of it.
There are three cities. There's the near north side. Unemployment is less than 2%. Northwestern, DePaul, the great universities are there. St. Joseph Hospital, the great hospitals are there, and Northwestern is on the north side of town. Suburbs have jobs on their signs, but there are nine communities between west and south side. Unemployment is above 20%. Pop is above 40%. In those areas, plants have left, schools have closed, and kids have killed each other. It's a disaster, and no one can afford to be indifferent to the pain and suffering on the citizens on the side of town where poverty abounds. We must learn somehow our own destiny is inextricably bound. And so we're three cities, really. There's the south and west side, and there's the north side, and there are suburbs, and there's not a natural separation. That's a social separation, and we should overcome it.
As I say, in the last 50 years, you really think since the civil rights movement really began, how are we still in this place?
Well, there's been such resistance. Some people profited from the separation. They exploit the divisions. If you put two seeds in the ground and water them both and put a wall between them, one will grow tall with multiples of fruit, and one will be stunted. Does that mean the taller one is better or the smaller one is less? It means that the one that had access to sunshine, something to call photosynthesis. Or you put a wall between two people. On the other side of the wall, the people you don't know, there's ignorance and hatred and fear and violence. When the walls come down, we can learn to... We can't be the big championship Cub or White Sox game. We cannot be the Alabama competing and defeating Georgia. We cannot do any of the things that we do that makes us great to move beyond the limits of race and gender and religion and learn to live together in a very cooperative spirit.
And that needs, of course, to continue. And one of the things I know that you've talked about before, I find this fascinating, from Dr. King, it was the significance of academic discipline. And this was helping, really. I mean, he kind of promoted that amongst everyone that worked with him because it was to help push the civil rights movement forward. But it was all about academic discipline, and it's something you've carried with you most of your life.
Well, strong minds break strong chains. We were trying to get 1,000 churches, for example, 1,000 churches, to one of the empty Sunday school rooms, as we've done at Rainbow Push, like 20 to 30 laptops, and teach our children the apps and codes, how to build websites, stock market games, and financial literacy. And that may be 1 million jobs open right now for people who are scientifically trained with that skill set. And we must train them, and we're trying to get the church involved in this generation of producing that skill set among our youth.
Yeah, there's a skills gap right now between what's unemployment and the jobs that are available and skills that are available.
Well, if you don't have that in inner city schools,
right,
you don't have it in inner city homes, you can't learn it.
No.
By osmosis. You would learn it by direct teaching.
Absolutely.
It's learnable, it's teachable, but it's not being taught. And therefore, we're having to assume a real aggressive role to teach stock market game and financial literacy and how to apps and make websites in our own communities.
I want to go back to, it was 50 years ago this April that Dr. King was assassinated. And the week before he was killed, you noted that polls at that time had indicated that 72% of whites were against him, but 55% of the black community had a negative view of him. How was that possible?
It was painful because many blacks who finally had public accommodation, the right to vote, waiting for the next level, they felt that our fight at the end of the war in Vietnam was a diversion from our struggle. He was attacked by black leadership, and when the pulpits were closed to him, he said, "I cannot bifurcate my sense of justice. I'm a Nobel Peace Prize winner. Money is this. Should go for war and poverty at home and healing. Go for the war on Vietnam and killing." We killed 3 million people in Vietnam. 3 million people.
Mm-hmm.
And he said bombs dropped in Vietnam will explode in our cities because of neglect and riots. He was right. And ultimately, we killed all those people, and now finally, Vietnam has won again. And just as Vietnam has won again, and the walls have come down in Germany, the walls must come down in Korea, and they must come down in the Middle East. We must choose ultimately, no matter how difficult it is, bridges over walls and learn to coexist, not co-annihilate.
The day he passed away, the day he was killed 50 years ago, what do you remember about the details of that day? You were with Dr. Jackson, or excuse me, you were with Dr. King.
Oh, boy. He had come to Memphis, and they held the plane up because he'd been threatened. They thought there was maybe a bomb on the plane. The plane finally came in. The picture of Dr. King and Hosea Williams and Abernathy and I walking on the balcony the day before he was killed. The day that he was killed, I had taken a group down from Chicago, Ben Branch and Wayne Bennett, some of the musicians, to sing for him that night at the Mason Temple Church rally. We were coming across the courtyard, and Dr. King said, "Jesse, you're always late. You don't even have on ties." I said, "Dr. King, you know you're an hour late." He laughed, because he was always an hour late. And he said, "You don't even have on ties." I said, "Dr. King, the prerequisite for eating is an appetite, not a tie." He said, "You're crazy." And we laughed. He bent over and said to Ben Branch, "Please play my favorite song tonight, Precious Lord." He had heard Ben play it on the saxophone. He had seen yes, or maybe a couple of weeks before. He raised his head and pow! The bullet hit him in the neck and severed his tie and blew his heart out, and he was dead. And we all gathered around and began to pray, and Dr. Abernathy was saying, "Rand Martin, don't leave us now." But he was dead upon impact. I got up and called Mrs. King and said, I was standing next door to him at Lorraine Motel. I said, "Mrs. King, I couldn't quite say what I had seen." I said, "Dr. King has been shot, I think, in the shoulder, but please come." She said, "I'll come as quick as I can." She was lying in bed reading the Bible, I think. And I guess in 7 or 8 minutes, the wire service called and said he was dead. He was one of those moments and a kind of pain in your gut you just never, ever forget. I don't like to talk about it, but I cannot avoid thinking about it almost in some way or another every day.
But did that pain in your gut, obviously, really, you said to yourself, you needed to take a bigger role.
The one bullet killer movement. So I've been working steadily since 50 years since he has left us.
Yeah.
And so I worked when we ran for the presidency, trying to expand democracy. That was trying to do Dr. King's work. We think we laid the groundwork for Barack Obama, who did such an excellent job as president. We think that the building multiracial coalitions of women and whites and blacks and Latinos and Asians and Arab Americans and Jewish Americans, building a rainbow coalition, that's our work, that's his vision.
Sure.
Learning to coexist and not co-annihilate, that is his vision, and we seek to carry it out all the time.
And tomorrow on Martin Luther King Day, I mean, you have the annual Reverend King Scholarship Breakfast that takes place at the Hyatt Regency in downtown Chicago, and this has been a long-standing tradition over 25 years and an outstanding way to bring young people into this whole conversation and to honor the life and legacy of Dr. King.
Well, one of the young women who could not afford to go to school 8 years ago, and we helped with the $5,000 and then the $25,000 scholarship, she was able to go and finish college. Now she's finished med school. She'll be honored tomorrow as a doctor.
That's awesome.
That's a source of great joy to see her come across that stage.
And for more on this event,
people who are listening now who may want to support, push for excellence as we seek to inspire youth to choose schools over jails and life over death and futures over funerals, to support a Rainbow Push, www.rainbowpush.org. But come to the breakfast, if you will. We need your financial support. We need your presence. We need your technical assistance. We need brothers and sisters must help brothers and sisters until all of us are set free together.
Absolutely.
And why do we do so well on the athletic field? Because whenever the playing field is even, and the rules are public, and the goals are clear, and the referees are fair, and the square is transparent, we all do well. Let's even the playing field. Let's make America great as it ought be and can be, not as it was.
And there's much more work to be done, and thank you for all your work, Reverend Jackson, and thank you for your time this Sunday morning.
Thank you.